This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Lina Mudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we look at progress made in health and medicine. We start with the fight against malaria. Cameroon just launched the world's first routine vaccine program against the disease. The RTSS vaccine, also known as Mosquirix, is being administered as part of a large-scale routine childhood immunization program following clinical trials of the drug in Ghana, Kenya, and Malawi. The injection is offered free of charge systematically to all children under 6 months of age at the same time as other traditional vaccines, according to the Cameroonian government. 19 other African countries plan to roll out the vaccines this year, targeting over 6 million children from 2024 to 2025, according to the Global Vaccine Alliance, Gavi. Now, for more on the subject, we are joined live via phone from Johannesburg, South Africa, for more insight, as I mentioned, by Thabani Maphosa. He's Gavi's Managing Director of Country Programs Delivery, overseeing Gavi's operations in 73 countries. Mr. Thabani Maphosa, thank you so much for joining us today. Do we have Mr. Maphosa on the line? Okay. All right. We will have Mr. Maphosa in a few minutes, but let's move now to the Congo Brazzaville. The United Nations reports more than 350,000 people have been devastated by the worst floods to hit Congo Brazzaville in 6 decades and urgently need humanitarian assistance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Official government figures put the death toll at 23, with 6,178 recorded displacements. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says it expects these figures to increase as UN and other agencies gain access to flooded areas. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says a total of 1.8 million people are affected by this flood disaster. He says gaining access to them is a challenge because the heavy flooding has caused severe damage to much of the infrastructure. He says many villages only can be reached by boat or canoe. He says the floods have left local communities without shelter or access to primary health services.
Villages, schools and health facilities have been flooded, and many water points and sanitation facilities are no longer functional. There's limited or no access to clean drinking water or sanitation in the worst affected areas, and that is in the central north of the country. Some 27,000 children are out of school.
Extreme rainfall since October has caused the banks around the Ubangi River, a tributary to the Congo River, to burst. The government declared a flood emergency on December 29th. Laerke says UN agencies and the government have developed a response plan with a budget of some $26 million. Priority needs, he says, include shelter, food, nutrition, health, and water, sanitation, and hygiene.
But that's just the immediate response. The floods could also have longer-term consequences. Our initial assessment estimates that 2,300 hectares of cultivated land have been flooded, which raises concern that means to produce food, for example, fruit trees and fishing gear, has been destroyed and livestock has perished.
Laerke says the UN has released $3 million from its emergency fund to provide immediate aid to 270,000 people in dire straits. These catastrophic events were not unexpected. In a seasonal forecast for October, November, December, the World Meteorological Organization predicted exceptionally heavy rainfall because of the El Niño phenomenon. The UN Weather Agency says lives could have been saved and the extent of damage could have been lessened had early warning systems been in place. However, it notes building such a system takes money, which the country does not have. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
We turn now to malaria, and we are joined by Mr. Thabane Maphosa. He's joining us live from South Africa. He's the Gavi's Managing Director of Country Programs Delivery, overseeing Gavi's operations in 73 countries. Mr. Maphosa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Cameroon just launched the world's first routine vaccine program against malaria. First off, let me have your reaction to this milestone, really, in public health.
Thank you so much. This is a significant milestone. The malaria vaccine has been under development for over 30 years. To come to a point where we have a viable vaccine that can be deployed at scale is indeed a significant milestone. But it is more significant because this vaccine is one of the most heavily tested and clinically tried vaccine in Africa, meaning that its development involved a number of African scientists and a number of African populations, thus being a vaccine that really truly responds to African needs.
So what did it take to get to this point? Let's go back to even the clinical trial, and even before the clinical trial, the development. It took over 30 years, as you mentioned. What did it take to get to the point where it was deemed ready, safe to try with among children?
Thank you. I think that there has been in the 30 years, it was really the method of production, and vaccines are tried, and sometimes they fail at clinical trial level. So it means that there were efforts over the years that were trying to develop it, and something wasn't holding and coming through. And so that's why it never went to the public at that particular time. But in this particular instance, there was something that was able to respond to the types of malaria that exist in Africa. Then the testing was done in 11 sites. It involved over 2 million children in three countries, that is Ghana in West Africa, and Kenya in East Africa, and Malawi in Southern Africa, just to see that it covers all strains. And there were a lot of, in the process of trials, studies, and verification of data before the supreme body, the SAGE, was able to actually make a recommendation that with all the data that it had, the vaccine was safe and it was efficacious, meaning that it could contribute as one of the set of tools of malaria to reduce mortality.
Now, rolling out a vaccine, a new vaccine, and more so adding it to routine childhood immunization is a big, big endeavor. Talk to us about what it's taking to make this happen and why was Cameroon the first country?
Thank you very much. Maybe let me start by talking about whether it's COVID vaccines or any vaccines that we have had to deal with. There is community engagement that is required. There is cold chain storage that is required that must be available and be able to take the vaccine. But there is also the healthcare workers that need to be trained and to be prepared and to be ready to administer the vaccine. What we normally say is that it takes three V's. The first is the vaccine itself, making sure that it is safe, it is stored well. But the next one is the vaccinator, which is your health workers that must really understand the dosage that needs to be used and what have you. Then lastly is the vaccinee, and these are the children and their caregivers who need to actually understand how this helps them and are competent to bring the children. And so the reason it takes a bit of time is all those studies, making sure that the communities are mobilized and they are educated. The health workers are trained to be able to vaccinate properly to avoid any issues. And the vaccine has a proper storage so that it doesn't spoil and it is safe when it gets to people. Why is Cameroon the first country? It's really a matter of a coincidence. Cameroon was approved along with another set of 17 countries, and it just happened to be one of those countries that had been approved and had an allocation that made sense. So it could have easily been Cameroon, it could have been Cote d'Ivoire, it could have been another country or Nigeria. So Cameroon being first is just that we had to start somewhere. But you will be seeing in the coming 2 months, 3 months, deliveries happening in other countries. And I think for me, for anyone in Cameroon, they should take it as a positive thing that their country was ready and ready to receive and administer this vaccine ahead of others along them.
You mentioned the three V's, vaccine, vaccinator, and vaccinee. Now, let's talk about the third V, the vaccinees. How are communities responding to the vaccine? How are they embracing this in the routine immunization? We know that vaccine resistance, vaccine skepticism have been a reality, especially we've experienced it through COVID. So talk to us about this experience.
That experience is real. That's why even when the vaccine was there, I was in Cameroon myself in December. And that's why we took a decision that we shouldn't be deploying the vaccine in December, but actually allow for an opportunity for education and mobilization and socialization where we need to draw from community leaders to actually engage their communities. We need to make sure that the healthcare workers and community health workers are mobilized to be part of educating their communities so that when they make this choice, they make it as an informed choice. So it is real, and that's why the rollout has to be thoughtful and it has to have proper community engagement.
That's great. That's great. Now, let's talk about the access. The vaccine is said to be administered for free. Is this model going to be replicated in other countries? Is it the set model where children will have the malaria vaccine for free, or is it a temporary phase?
No, thank you very much. In all countries that are Gavi eligible, it will continue to be free. Malaria is a significant disease in the continent of Africa. And when we had COVID, I remember some of the African leaders and ministers saying that they do want to respond to COVID, but they would hope that a malaria vaccine would be there soon. When I visited Nigeria sometime last year, I heard that the number of children that were dying of malaria on an everyday basis was at an alarming level that there was a feeling that it was as if we were back to the HIV pandemic when we were losing people so often. And so when you think about a disease like malaria that has been really causing havoc over many years, this is something that is welcome as part of the tools to respond and to fight against malaria.
Talk to us about the role of Gavi when it comes to such an endeavor where you have multi you have different parties that are involved, because to deploy a vaccination campaign like that, it takes multiple people, multiple entities in collaboration. What role is Gavi playing in this scenario?
Gavi plays two roles specifically, Linod. The first one is the role of making sure that vaccines are procured and making sure that countries are ready. But in making sure that countries are ready, it's about making sure that there is technical assistance and partners that support countries to get to that level of readiness. So there is the vaccine procurement, which we do, and then there is the technical readiness and bringing in partners that can support the country, whether it's civil society or it's UNICEF or WHO and others who can actually support a country to be ready.
What about the role of governments? How do you collaborate with local governments as you move from one country to another?
The role of local government is that, you know, they are the duty bearers for their communities. The malaria vaccine, for instance, at the moment, we don't have enough. And the government have to tell us which areas have a high disease burden, so that in the prioritization process, we work with them to actually make sure they've got supply that responds to those areas that have a high burden of malaria. But the governments are also the ones that pay the healthcare workers. So the other V, which is the healthcare workers, the vaccinators, is really paid for by the government. So the government has got to provide those resources and make sure that they are responsible. But there also is a need through the government institutions to monitor that this vaccine is not causing any harm, so that if ever there was a sense of any harm, it is reported and it is investigated so that the public is continually protected and we continue to learn.
The WHO has given the green light to two vaccines, the RTS Mosquirix, which is being deployed now in Cameroon, and the R21, actually, that received clearance before the RTSS. Well, the RTSS first, and then the RT21, I think, is still in the works to finalize it. Talk to us about these two vaccines and how they are going to be used together, separately, in the prospect of immunizing children in routine immunization.
No, thank you very much. You know, the first thing, and it goes back, Linod, to my point that R21 is welcome. Is a welcome introduction, because the supply that we had for RTSS was not enough for the demand that we had. And so by having R21, at least we improve the supply constraint and we make it, we have more availability. It means that we can support more countries, more children, both are equally efficacious. At this particular moment, they will be used exactly the same way. But I think what is particularly important for me is that more children will be reached. At the beginning, we will not use both in the same country, so that we can actually spread and make sure that the monitoring and the studying that always continues is not confounded by mixing them up.
And Mr. Maposa, before we wrap, what is the main takeaway here in this moment that we are living now, where malaria vaccination is being introduced in routine immunization? What is the message? What is the takeaway?
The message is that we have an additional tool to fight malaria. This tool must be used with other tools that have existed, which is the bed nets and other things. We hope that we will not be losing as many of our children as we have in the past. So the significance of this moment is that we have another line of defense of fighting against malaria, but it cannot be used alone. It must be used in combination and in conjunction with the other tools.
Tabani Maposa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Linot. Thank you.
That was Tabani Maposa, Gavi's Managing Director of Country Programs Delivery. We turn now to medical breakthroughs and discoveries, from cutting-edge technologies to groundbreaking medical research. Digital transformation is impacting the way healthcare is provided and will likely drive the future of health. Observers say healthcare promises to be nothing short of revolutionary in the coming years. This includes, among other things, artificial intelligence, AI, and personalized medicine using people's DNA to tailor their healthcare. Here in the United States, where regulators have approved two new gene therapies for sickle cell disease, the Food and Drug Administration says the one-time treatments can be used for patients 12 and older with severe forms of the disease.
Regulators approved two new gene therapies for sickle cell disease that doctors hope can cure the painful, inherited blood disorder that afflicts mostly black people in the United States. The Food and Drug Administration said the one-time treatment can be used for patients 12 and older with severe forms of the disease.
I think this announcement of the approval of gene therapy is potentially game-changing for a number of patients. Many patients lack the availability to do a stem cell transplant. And so for those patients, it often means a life filled with pain and with repeated hospitalizations and lots of complications. And this potentially offers a chance to alleviate those.
The disease affects hemoglobin, the protein in red blood cells that carries oxygen. A genetic mutation causes the cells to become sickle or crescent-shaped, which can block blood flow, cause excruciating pain, organ damage, strokes, or other problems.
I know for someone like myself who goes through red cell exchanges once every 7 to 8 weeks, this one-time kind of cure, I think, is very, very, very much so needed. Again, for someone like me, cuts down having to go to the hospital every month and to doing this treatment and then just getting regularly checked by my doctor. So I think it's something that's really needed for this sickle cell community.
Current treatments include medication and blood transfusions. The only permanent solution is a bone marrow transplant, which must come from a closely matched donor without the disease and brings a risk of rejection.
I think this is a giant leap forward in gene therapy for treatment of chronic diseases. And so this is the first step forward. And I think in the future, we're going to see a lot more diseases that are able to be treated with gene therapy.
The Vertex treatment was recently authorized in Britain and Bahrain and is currently under review elsewhere.
Artificial intelligence is revolutionizing medicine, but to what extent can it be replace humans? Let's go to Sweden, where AI has been used during a clinical trial for breast cancer screenings to improve diagnosis and cut down on radiologists' workloads. But researchers say the interim results of the study completed in August show the tool is not yet ready to replace the oversight of radiologists.
Artificial intelligence can be used in breast cancer screenings to improve diagnosis and cut down on radiologists' workloads, according to a Swedish clinical trial. But researchers say the interim results of the study, completed in August, show the tool is not yet ready to replace the oversight of radiologists. Lund University says about 1 million women are called to mammogram screenings every year in Sweden. The breast X-ray images are then typically reviewed by two radiologists to ensure any possible cancers are spotted. It's a time-consuming task. On average, one radiologist can read about 50 screenings per hour. But can tech help cut down that workload? Researchers here in southern Sweden are assessing the effect of artificial intelligence-supported screenings. It's the first randomized trial comparing the two methods of diagnosis.
So first we read the screening examination without AI, and then we use our advantages that are we can see the whole image, we can compare with priors, we see the clinical context, and we do what you usually do. And then when we're ready, we put on the AI tool, and then we can see the markings in the image.
The interim results of the study were published in the medical journal Lancet Oncology earlier this month, but research is ongoing. In the trial, which included over 80,000 women, researchers used AI software to identify screenings with a high risk of breast cancer. These then underwent traditional double readings of radiologists. But the remaining examinations classified as low risk were read by just one radiologist. Doctors used AI software as a kind of detection support, which highlighted suspicious findings for further investigation.
Here, AI has marked a small finding in the image, and it forces us to check this. And we take off the CAD mark. We can see here that it's a small speculations here. So this is the recall, and we did a 3D mammography. And then it emphasizes this speculated tumor here. After we read the screening exam, we put on the AI. So we just press on a button here. And then you can see here that AI has marked a finding here on the image. And it gives a regional score. In 81, it's a high score. And then we take off the CAD mark and we analyze this here. And we can see, well, actually here it's a subtle speculated mass that is partly covered by dense tissue. And this woman was recalled, and after we did an assessment, we found a 5 millimeter invasive cancer. But I think this illustrates well the possibilities with using AI in the screen reading.
The trial results found AI-supported mammography screening resulted in a similar cancer detection rate compared with standard double readings. It also almost halved doctors' workloads. Screen reading was reduced by about 44%. Lang says such time saving could be vital, particularly in poor staff medical settings.
I think it is exciting because we are lacking physicians all over, and especially breast radiologists we are lacking, and now we have a valuable tool to reduce the workload. And even as it was not my goal, and I didn't know if we would end there, but it, as it turns out, it has been even an improvement to the quality to put in AI.
In low and middle income countries, there's a huge lack of doctors. So these algorithms trained on large data can, of course, make a really big difference in this area where there are no experts. Lower resource settings, that has a huge potential.
The Swedish researchers say the next step is to investigate what cancer types were detected with and without AI support. 100,000 women have now been enrolled on the trial.
Now imagine donning a scuba suit just to get some exercise. For people recovering from serious injuries, the chance to work out underwater is worth the extra effort. An Australian study is now examining how immersion therapy could benefit more people with brain and spinal conditions.
In 2009, Jamieson was injured at work. A year ago, he decided to give immersion therapy a try. This is not your ordinary workout session. It involves putting on scuba diving equipment and exercising underwater.
I like getting in there with the weights and doing some good, decent, honest exercise. I've had 5 surgeries on the back, multiple surgeries all over the body, probably 40 in total. There were times where I just couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel, and things were very tough.
A new study of people who have brain and spinal injuries is encouraging them to exercise underwater in scuba gear. There's already a lot of anecdotal evidence that underwater immersion therapy is working. Now, researchers want this new study to show how and why it's effective.
By getting them underwater, we think we can challenge that interaction between the brain and the body completely differently.
Others aren't so sure the therapy works and point to potential safety risks.
The immersion is useful and helpful for many of these clients, but not necessarily with their head underwater.
Adelaide Best Determine 2, which provides immersion therapy, says that participants must be eligible before being allowed to take part in sessions. It also points out that more than 10,000 sessions have taken place without any incident.
Feeling better, more energy, eating better, sleeping better. If I fall over in the water, I'm not going to fall flat on my face. I'm not going to re-aggravate an injury.
The therapy technique is now being rolled out all over Australia and New Zealand. And the results of the study are expected in 2 to 3 years.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. I'm your host, Lenore Mudo in Washington. Thank you for joining us. I'm with producer Kwame Ofori. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.